You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
You have to make your reputation on being honest and unmerciful.
Honest and unmerciful. Good advice for a budding rock critic. Also a fine description of the man who spoke those lines, the late Philip Seymour Hoffman, as Lester Bangs there in Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous. We'll devote this week's show to Hoffman and his tragically short career as we share our top five Philip Seymour Hoffman scenes.
Listeners will weigh in, too, with their memories of Hoffman and his finest performances. That and more ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store.
For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM2. And stay tuned a bit later in the show where we'll feature some listener Squarespace sites. You're listening to Film Spotting. This week, we remember Philip Seymour Hoffman. We'll get to our favorite Hoffman scenes in just a bit, but let's start with Hoffman the man. Here he is at the height of his professional career, his 2006 Oscar win for Capote. This is how he ended his speech.
And my mom's name is Marilyn O'Connor, and she's here tonight. And I'd like, if you see her tonight, to congratulate her, because she brought up four kids alone. And she deserves a congratulations for that. And we're at the party, Ma, you know. She took me to my first play, and she stayed up with me and watched the NCAA Final Four. And her passions became my passions. And, be proud, Mom, because I'm proud of you. And we're here tonight. And it's so good. Thank you.
Josh, we're spending the show reflecting on Hoffman, the actor. But, of course, that clip reminds us he was also a son, a dad, a brother, a friend. And that Oscar speech is also a good place to start our conversation about our favorite moments, I think, from Hoffman's career, because it was a lead performance. And as you know, and have probably experienced yourself a little bit, Sam Van Halgren is not only our producer here on Film Spotting, he's also my priest. I go to confession. Mm-hmm. I seek absolution from him for sins I've committed, or sometimes sins I'm about to commit. And what was really weighing on me as I prepared my top five Philip Seymour Hoffman scenes this week was I felt like Synecdoche, New York had to be represented on this list. But no matter how hard I tried, despite how many good scenes I could come up with from that film, which I do really love, and how good Philip Seymour Hoffman is in that film, I just couldn't find the right fit. And I knew it probably wasn't in the mix for your list either, so I was feeling extra bad. And Sam said something interesting about Hoffman and the roles he chose, that one of the main characteristics of his lead performances, and his performance in Synecdoche, New York in particular, this is true of, they're really defined by subtlety. They're often very low-key. It's the supporting turns where he's often much more dramatic or at least more demonstrative, and he does steal those scenes, I think you could argue. As I looked over my list, I only had one lead performance. The other four were supporting turns. Did you find a similar mix with your list?
Looking over it as you're talking here, yeah, I think I only have what would be considered two lead performances, and they're actually both co-leads in a way. I think the interesting thing about him when you think of this lead supporting performance thing is that he was still a character actor when he did get a lead role, and maybe that's a little bit what Sam meant. And by that, I mean character actors, if you define them as actors who don't have to worry about gaining the audience sympathy. Now, you could argue that no actor should worry about that, that the best acting is when you set that aside. But be that as it may, most lead performances do have that facet to it.
Mm-hmm.
Hoffman never seemed to worry about that. He was playing to the character first and fully to that character. And supporting performances can get away with that a little bit more. Character actors can get away with that. We're more forgiving as audiences, I think. And he just employed that same tactic when he did have the lead. I'm going to start with a supporting performance, though, and it comes from Magnolia. It's the scene where his character is trying to reach Frank T.J. Mackey through a phone call.
Well, there's no number for Frank in any of her old stuff, you know, and he's pretty out of it. I mean, like I said, he's dying. Dying of cancer.
This is just one of the many story threads in Paul Thomas Anderson's 1999 opus, and it does involve Phil Parma, who's played by Hoffman. He's a domestic nurse, and he's serving Jason Robards' dying TV producer here, trying to reach the producer's estranged son. That's the character played by Tom Cruise. And in this scene, he calls an acquaintance of the son, begs him to connect them.
Wait, I'm sorry, so why call me?
I know this sounds silly. And I know that I might sound ridiculous, like this is the scene of the movie where the guy's trying to get a hold of the long-lost son, you know, but this is that scene. This is that scene. And I think they have those scenes in movies because they're true, you know, because they really happen. And you gotta believe me, this is really happening. I mean, I can give you my number and you can go check with whoever you gotta check with and call me back, but do not leave me hanging on this. All right, please. I'm just, please. See, this is the scene of the movie where you helped me out.
For me, this was an example of what Hoffman added to the words on the page, even though Paul Thomas Anderson, we both revere as a writer and a director. This scene is very self-referential in calling attention to scenes in movies.
Yeah.
And that might not work. It's dangerous here to put in a phrase, this is the scene. I think it really only works because of Hoffman. It's because he hits that other level about halfway through when the desperation kicks in, when he really begs for help. Suddenly Hoffman makes these words only the characters. We seem to forget that they're the screenplay's words, even though they're screenplay words referring to screenplays. That just disappears because of Hoffman's delivery. He gets completely lost in the urgency of the moment, and so do we. It was very interesting as you were asking me to look over my list generally and see what popped up as repeated themes. Phone calls repeated up for me, and I'll probably get to another one here in a minute. There's even another phone call scene in Magnolia that's really good where he's ordering groceries.
I had
to consider both of those.
Do you still need the peanut butter?
Whittling down that list to the essentials.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess this just proves also that he didn't even need other actors to make a moment really sing.
No, he did not. Following that up, an email from a listener, Kennedy in Vancouver, who writes, he was in so many ways our actor. Like you, Adam, we first remember his small but nearly omnipresent role in Twister, the best thing in a tepid film. But Magnolia was really where I came to realize how great he was. And he never, and I truly mean that, no hyperbole, never failed to deliver. He was always worth watching on screen. I can't name another actor I really feel that way about. That we will never see him fail is such a tragedy. Too young, too soon, too many roles left unrealized. We were blessed that he was amongst us. Well said there, Kennedy. Thank you for that note. For me, Josh, as I was laying out this list, and this was as hard as any top five list we've ever had to put together, frankly, because of the subject matter and reflecting on these great scenes and that great too short career, and yet we got so many memorable moments and films out of it.
He was so prolific, too.
He really was. IMDb has 63 credits. Yeah. That includes some things that are still coming out, but he really did fit so much in and made the most out of what he did on screen. It wasn't just about what Philip Seymour Hoffman is doing in the scene, though that's paramount. It also wasn't just about how good the scene is in general, the writing, the acting from the other people in it, the editing, whatever it might be. It also wasn't about how good the movie is. But all of those things did matter to me. I was thinking of this as putting together the Philip Seymour Hoffman reel, the one that showcases not only his range of talent, but the range of his achievements. And I also did factor in what came to mind immediately. When I thought of Philip Seymour Hoffman, what were the first handful of scenes that popped into my head? They were obviously doing that for a reason. They were my go-to scenes because they were that memorable.
Yeah, you got to go with your gut to a degree on a list like this.
You do, and it's easy to label so many of his characters as weird, many of them arguably losers. But the thing I noticed, Josh, is that even the non-losers are outsiders. They're all misfits, at least on my list. And I think if you look over his filmography, you'll see that pattern. Whether they're misfits among their peers, in their professions, in their towns, or their society as a whole, often they're either suffering from an inferiority complex or a superiority complex or some fascinating combination of the two. So he played characters who seemed sometimes imbued with some truth, some knowledge. They were a leader, or he played the type of weak men who you could easily see following such a leader, and they had almost no identity at all. That's maybe why you see so many tributes to Hoffman over the past few weeks mentioning his uncanny ability to disappear into roles. And one of those roles, and one of those weak men, one of those ciphers he played, is my number five, Scotty J, in the Paul Thomas Anderson movie Boogie Nights. The scene is really his showcase scene in that movie, I'm an Idiot. This is one where he just refuses to let us, the audience, dismiss Scotty as the slightly creepy boom guy, someone to laugh at because he's so clearly in love with Dirk Diggler, played by Mark Wahlberg, and so clearly wants to impress him. It is kind of pathetic. But the way Hoffman brings us in is by exposing Scotty at his most vulnerable, his most raw, his most human. This is the scene on New Year's Eve. He brings Dirk out to show him his new car and comes on to Dirk.
All right, open up. This is it.
It's cool.
Yeah. You want to get inside?
When did you get this?
Yesterday. Well, actually, I had it painted yesterday, so it might be painting, like, still be kind of stickier.
This is great, man.
Yeah.
This is really great.
You want to go for a ride, or?
Wait. Hell, how much time is that?
I'm sorry,
sir. What the hell was the matter with you?
I'm sorry.
Why did you do that, Scotty?
The scene is one take, actually. It's handheld, but there is a cut to Scotty getting in the car, and this is where he admonishes himself for blowing it with Dirk. And the camera sits on him as he repeats that line, I'm an idiot, and he cries.
I'm a fucking idiot.
And one of the things I've always thought about that scene, that moment in the scene, Josh, is that it seems so vulnerable and raw, actually, that it might have been the kind of moment that only happens when a director lets an actor go, puts the camera on him, they've already got the take or couple takes they need, and says, you know what, you've got some room to just take this wherever you need to take it to. Just live in that moment, and let's see where the character goes. Could it have been written? Of course. Especially from Paul Thomas Anderson, it could have been, and I haven't listened to any commentaries on Boogie Nights, so I don't know if that scene is ever discussed, but I wasn't surprised in thinking about this to turn up an old version of the screenplay for Boogie Nights online and find that that's not in the scene. The scene as written actually ends with Hoffman saying goodbye to Dirk as he goes back inside and saying I love you to him, but we don't get that coda, and the coda is absolutely everything to that scene, and I really do wonder if that was something that he just let Hoffman have that moment.
Well, if that's true, that explains the trust that they then had for a number of films as they went on together.
That's a good point. However, it ended up in the film, Hoffman nailed Scotty's defining trait, which is also arguably the defining trait of every character in the movie. Think about Jack and his dreams of making a real movie, Roller Girl being mocked by her classmates, Amber, played by Julianne Moore, being told she's not a good enough mother, Dirk wanting to prove to his mom and the world that he's going to be someone special. Right down the line, they're all drowning in self-loathing. And in that scene, Hoffman makes that character maybe the most relatable, sympathetic character in that entire porn panoramic. And that says something, that he can pull that off in such a short amount of time.
I'm really glad that made your list. I had a feeling it would, so I didn't include it. But I think that's the first time I really noticed Philip Seymour Hoffman. Looking back in the filmography, too, that does make sense. Don't remember him so much in Twister from the year before, but Boogie Nights, yeah, all of a sudden, this was a guy we really needed to watch. Boy, I think a listener sent in an email asking us if we could do these lists without mentioning Paul Thomas Anderson movies.
Apparently not.
We didn't consider that, and it's a good thing, because I'm going to keep the streak going here with my number four. And it's also, if we have a film spotting alert system about breaking rules, it may go off at this moment, because I'm going to mention Punch Drunk Love again. And not only that, I'm going to mention a scene that I've already talked about. We did our top five movie phone calls in March of 2012, and the shut up rage off between Hoffman and Adam Sandler was on my list then. It was my number three. What's worse, Punch Drunk Love is currently in my penalty box, so I'm just busting all sorts of rules, but I think we'll let it go for a special list like this.
Absolutely.
This is the scene where Adam Sandler is Barry Egan. He's got a customer service complaint about the phone sex line that he's called, and Philip Seymour Hoffman's Dean the Mattress Man Trumbull, he picks up the phone.
Who's this?
Hello, sir. My name's Barry Egan. I called your service the other night.
Shut the up.
Oh, what's that?
I said calm down and shut the up. What's the problem?
The problem is, if you give me a chance to explain, one of your employees, that girl who I was just speaking with, has been threatening me, and four blonde gentlemen just attacked me and smashed my car and hurt my girl.
All right, go f*** yourself. That shit has nothing to do with me. All right, I run a legitimate business here.
Listen to me. What's your name, sir? Answer me!
What's your name, asshole?
I'm Barry Egan!
How do I know? You can be anybody.
You're a bad person. You have no right taking people's confidence in your service. You understand me, sir?
You're sick.
No.
Shut up! Shut the f*** up!
No right to take people's
confidence. Shut up! Will you shut up? Shut up! Shut up! Shut up!
It really takes a special talent, I think, to outrage Adam Sandler, but that's what Hoffman does here. And it's indicative of the way, as you mentioned, he could momentarily steal an entire movie pretty much from anyone. It's awfully showy, I'll admit that, but it does fit also within the heightened state of mania that Anderson has created for this whole picture. I mean, every element is tuned to this degree, from the performances to the way the camera moves to the discordant soundtrack. Everything's shouting the way Hoffman does here, and they keep ratcheting things up. Great scene. It's one of my favorite scenes in the movie. And I should also mention, we got an email from Andy Wilkowska in St. Paul, Minnesota. He suggested the outtake from Punch Drunk Love, in which Hoffman's mattress man does an infomercial for his legit business. And if anyone's seen it, you know it's on YouTube, I believe. He's falling off the roof onto a mattress, and Hoffman just keeps going. I don't know if that was part of the plan or not, but it just keeps going with it, and really a great outtake. Couldn't include it for this list, but worth a mention.
Yeah, so many listeners on our Facebook page did mention Dean Trumbull, Mattress Man, not only that phone call, but that outtake, that commercial. So I'm glad we got in a mention of it there. Before we get to my number four, let's hear a listener voicemail. This is Andrew in Western Australia with some love for an early Philip Seymour Hoffman performance.
My contribution isn't quite a top five contender for Philip Seymour Hoffman scenes, as most of my real picks will probably get picked by contributors already. But it's definitely one that I've always remembered. It's Philip Seymour Hoffman as George Willis Jr. in the Al Pacino movie Scent of a Woman from 1992. It's the first time I ever really took notice of him, because he was so obnoxious in the earlier parts of the film. But then he was such a weasel on the closing scene. You could see how much range he had from that early appearance.
I think, like Andrew, we all took notice of Philip Seymour Hoffman in Scent of a Woman, and we just maybe weren't aware that we were taking notice of him. Certainly the name didn't mean anything to us, but I think back to his performance there as George, just so smugly entitled. Yet he plays it with that sense of a guy who clearly is a screw-up, who is going to do some bad things to his family name and legacy, and yet that doesn't deter him at all from just being an unbelievable bastard throughout that whole film. My number four pick comes from the movie Happiness, from writer-director Todd Solondz, and there were a handful of scenes for me to consider here. But in thinking about Hoffman's character Alan, it's funny coming off my pick of Scotty J from Boogie Nights in number five, because other than the boldness of the kiss when he comes on to Dirk Diggler, Scotty is the most unassuming and passive guy in that film. He's the last guy in any room you're going to pay attention to. In Happiness, Hoffman's Alan is similar, except during his obscene phone calls. This is where he can act out these sexual fantasies. And not only that, his fantasies of being in command, not being a doormat, or even worse, just being completely invisible. He can actually get what he wants, or can project the fantasy of what he wants anyway. And what he wants is his neighbor Helen, who's a writer who has her own self-worth issues. She's played by Laura Flynn Boyle. And my number four scene here is the prank call. I believe it's the first prank call he makes to her from his office.
Hello?
I know who you are, and you are nothing. You think you are f***ing something, but you are f***ing nothing. You are empty. You are a zero. You are a black hole, and I'm going to f*** you so bad you're going to be coming out of your ears.
He calls her from his cubicle at work, and I just love the audacity of him calling her from his cubicle at work. Like, he has to get it out so badly that he can't help himself. He's going to call her in the middle of the day and try to pull it off quietly so no one around him hears. And I love the reversal when she star 69s him and calls him back.
What do you want?
I want you to f*** me.
I don't think I can do that.
He goes from being authoritarian to being the little boy who got caught with his hand in the cookie jar. And Hoffman conveys it all with his breath. He is breathing heavy. He's really worked up. He's telling her how worthless she is and all the things he's going to do to her. And then when she calls him back, you get that slight gasp as he hears her voice and hangs up. And the way he says, I don't think I can do that, like he just fell off his bike and he's asking his mommy to make the scrape on his knee feel better, it all culminates with him taking on yet another persona, Alan, the regular guy.
Hey, Alan, did you see the playoffs last night?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good.
I was on my knees praying for that shot.
It worked.
His voice changes. He becomes more boisterous. He has a hearty laugh. Everybody in that film, Happiness, is putting on a face to meet the faces they meet. They're all frauds on some level. Some of them are truly monsters on the inside, we come to learn, but they're projecting integrity and honesty on the outside. Alan, I think, in rewatching that scene and a few others from Happiness, it hit me that he's just the one who wears the most faces, and Hoffman puts all of them on in a 2-minute span.
In one scene.
Yeah,
it actually makes me think of a scene I considered from Doubt where he's the priest and he's giving a sermon that involves a story. And as he's telling the story, he adopts a couple different voices. And I was thinking that same thing. He's putting on a multi-performance in
there
this one little scene. He could do that. We'll finish our lists of Philip Seymour Hoffman's best scenes later in the show. Before that, we're going to play Massacre Theater, share the film spotting poll, and I'll give a first impression of the RoboCop screening I just came from. Right now, we're going to let Hoffman as Lester Bangs do the honors and choose our music for the break. It's all you, Lester. Stay with us.
Iggy Pop! Man, I just put this on. This isn't on your playlist either.
I just think it's a little bit early for that.
Not for me.
I must keep walking, cheetah with a hat full of napalm. Runaway son of the nuclear aid bomb. I am the world's forgotten boy, the one who searches and destroys. Mother, gotta help me, please. Somebody gotta save my soul. Baby, that's late for me. Oh! Look out, honey, cause I'm using technology.
Quick interruption here, folks, to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM2.
A couple listener sites we want to promote here that were built with the Squarespace platform. This comes to us via Twitter, Burger and Wise. That's at Burger and Wise, W-I-S-E. They say our Squarespace site hosts our food cartoons and film biz comic strip, The Pitchers. You can find that at burgerandwise.squarespace.com. We'll link to it in the show notes, of course. And I did visit this site here, Josh, recently, and took a look at some of those strips, The Pitchers, very, very funny stuff. Dave Coletta, who comes to us from Twitter as well, says, this is my Lego site. A few film-inspired builds in there. You can see those at davecoletta.com. We'll also link to that site in our show notes at filmspotting.net. Seemed appropriate, Josh, with the Lego movie out. So
perfect.
Thank you, Dave, and thank you, Burger and Wise. If you have a Squarespace site you want us to promote, just email us feedback@filmspotting.net. We always hear from our listeners about how easy the Squarespace platform is. It's all drag and drop. They offer 24/7 support, and they give you connected accounts so you can connect Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Pinterest, Instagram, Google, and many more web and social services. They also offer e-commerce to their platform. So if you want to set up a shop and sell things, you can do that in just a few minutes. They also have, I've mentioned this a couple of times, Josh, the Squarespace Metric app for iPhone and iPad, so you can check your site stats like page views, unique visitors, and more. It's all right there if you have the Squarespace Metric app, and it all starts at just $8 a month and includes a free domain name if you sign up for 1 year.
You don't need a credit card to start a trial. Just go ahead and begin building your website. And when you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code FILM2 to get 10% off and to show your support for Film Spotting. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
Hey Adam, Josh, this is Travis from Utah. I just wanted to weigh in on Philip Seymour Hoffman since you guys are doing the show on him. I just wanted to just say how great of an actor he was and how what a big loss it is for film that this happened. I think he's one of the best character actors that there was. He seemed to elevate every movie that he was in, no matter how small the role was. It's a sad loss, and he'll definitely be missed. So thanks for letting me share.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That was Film Spotting listener Travis from Utah expressing his thoughts on the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman. We'll return to our top five Philip Seymour Hoffman scenes a bit later in the show.
It's time now for Massacre Theater. We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this scene with the help of the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips.
I thought I told you to turn off your phone.
Turn off my phone? Turn off my phone?
Yeah.
Earth to Matilda, this phone is as much a part of me as...
You know what? Can we just cut it out with all the Earth twos, please?
We're not actually saying this is the Earth calling you, Matilda.
Yeah, no, I got that. I understand you don't literally mean...
No, I don't think you do. Listen, it's not like we think that we're actually in a control tower trying to reach outer space aliens or something, okay? Hello.
That was Ben Stiller as Derek Zoolander, Christine Taylor as Matilda Jeffries, and Owen Wilson as Hansel in Zoolander from 2001.
He's so hot right now.
Directed and co-written by Stiller along with Drake Sather and John Hamburg. And Adam, I just have to commend you on your perfect, impeccable Derek Zoolander. Also offer my condolences that your best impression so far has been Derek Zoolander.
I don't know what that says about me. I think with the listener who said it proves that at least I have something more to offer than just being really, really, really good looking.
This is true.
Philip Schmidt in Cleveland says, Earth to Adam and Josh. It's clearly Zoolander, but I'm not sure on the connections. Here are three Philip offers. It is a movie sort of about fame, with Derek Starr gradually fading in the rising brightness that is Hansel. Yes, that's where we were going. That was it. We were going Zoolander strictly because it was a movie about fame. But Phillips got two other good ones here. David Bowie makes a brief cameo to officiate a walk-off, and his song Fame was quoted so eloquently by Josh in the last episode.
Very nice.
Didn't think about that one at all. Number three from Philip. It's certainly not a guilty pleasure that Roger Ebert championed, and this really was just serendipity here, something we didn't consider at all. We weren't even aware of this, but we did discuss last week the Roger Ebert documentary from director Steve James called Life Itself. And we had many listeners actually who were aware of this little history between Stiller and Zoolander and Ebert.
Francis in Bethesda, Maryland gave us a little background here. Ebert panned Zoolander. Famously, he said, there have been articles lately asking why the United States is so hated in some parts of the world. As this week's Exhibit A from Hollywood, I offer Zoolander, a comedy about a plot to assassinate the Prime Minister of Malaysia because of his opposition to child labor. You might want to read that sentence twice. Related and continuing the opposite theme, you guys talked about one of the greatest actors of our time, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Ben Stiller is arguably the worst actor of our time.
Ouch.
Wow,
that's a shot.
That's a little harsh, Francis.
Yes, it is. But Francis was among a handful of listeners who knew of that and wrote in, which was fantastic. Chris Moody in Tetbury, England closes us out. He says, it's a small and surely inevitable step from summer film courses to the Adam Kempinar Center for Kids Who Can't Read Good But Want to Learn How to Watch Films Good, too. Come on, Film Spotting Nation. We can make it happen.
I'll get you started with the first donation.
Love it. If you want to hear that scene, plus our top five movies about fame and our review of the Roger Ebert documentary Life Itself, you can get that show at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. And just after we recorded last week, it was announced that Life Itself was picked up for distribution by Magnolia Pictures.
Fantastic.
So there are some screenings of it that we mentioned last week, but those are all just crowdfunded screenings. There aren't really any theatrical showings of it until it looks like this summer, thanks to Magnolia. So a lot of listeners were somewhat embarrassed, some not embarrassed at all, that
a lot of references to college days.
Yeah,
in the
college
emails.
Days, they really recognize right away.
Trying to blame
that
it on
scene
college.
From Zoolander. Why don't you reach into the brewing film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner?
The winner is Josh Glover from West Fargo, North Dakota.
Congratulations, Josh. Email feedback at filmspotting.net to claim your film spotting t-shirt.
Do we go right into the sex?
I need some more film.
Is that all right? You don't need a rehearsal?
No, it's okay. I can do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then we'll shoot the rehearsal.
Great.
Moving on to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, can't wait to see what tie-ins our listeners come up with, as, once again, we only have one tie-in we have in mind, and it's a little bit off the beaten path. You gotta stretch out a little bit to find it, I think, but it is there. That's all we're going to give you. We are, though, going to give you a hint by way of keeping the names what they are. I don't think they're so identifiable and recognizable that it's a huge hint, so we're going to leave them in rather than trying to come up with something clever. I think we're all clevered out at this point. Josh, I'm going to start it off. You're going to give me the action.
All right, are you ready?
I am ready.
And action.
Jack?
Mm-hmm?
How come you're so good?
I ain't.
You pick five times more than me.
Well, I'm bigger than you are.
You know every story in Scripture.
Well, you know every song in Mama's hymnal.
Songs are easy.
It ain't for me.
There's more words in the Bible than in the Heavenly Highway hymns.
Look, JR, if I'm going to be a preacher one day, I got to know the Bible front to back. I mean, you can't help nobody if you can't tell them the right story.
And scene. A nice plaintive scene there.
Another clue we should probably mention, there are crickets in the background
yes,
of that
crickets,
scene.
That...
So.
That'll really give it away. If you know what movie we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, February 17th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China. All to myself, alone. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all your lovers a-weeping on a faraway shore.
Ah, the song I serenade Josh with so often here between segments.
And I still don't understand what it means here or in the film.
That is Philip Seymour Hoffman as Lancaster Dodd in The Master, the 2012 Paul Thomas Anderson movie. Last week when we asked you about your favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman supporting performance, we did exclude The Master. You can take your pick here what the reason was. Either we forgot, possible.
Or it's always possible.
It does seem like more of a co-lead performance than a supporting performance. The movie is called The Master, after all.
Let's go with that reasoning.
In addition to that Oscar-nominated performance, we also excluded the Oscar-nominated performance from Hoffman in Doubt, opposite Meryl Streep, and his Oscar-nominated turn as Gust in Charlie Wilson's War. That's just one measure, I think, of how many truly memorable performances Hoffman gave. The options, though, we did give you for favorite Hoffman supporting performance were Lester Bangs in Almost Famous, Scotty J in Boogie Nights, Brandt in The Big Lebowski, Allen in Happiness, Owen Davey in The Bad Guy in Mission Impossible 3, or you could go Dean Trumbull Mattress Man in Punch Drunk Love. Finally, if you had to give love to Charlie Wilson's War or that performance in Doubt or Before the Devil Knows You're Dead or so many other ones, maybe Art Howe in Moneyball, you could have selected other. Josh, how did it come out?
Owen Davian, the villain from Mission Impossible 3, was in last place with 6%. One of your picks, Adam, Allen from Happiness, 7% of the vote. The Big Lebowski, Philip Seymour Hoffman as Brandt there, 10% of the vote. My pick arrives right in the middle here with 15%. That would be Dean Trumbull, Mattress Man from Punch Drunk Love. A lot of people did decide to go with other, not surprisingly, so that received 16% of the vote. Up at the top here, another one of your picks, Scotty J from Boogie Nights, Adam with 22%, but that was beat out by Lester Bangs from Almost Famous, 24%.
That scene in the limo from The Big Lebowski, not going to make either of our lists, spoiler alert. because it really doesn't showcase Hoffman all that much in it. At least that's my reason. But if you were picking just the best Philip Seymour Hoffman scene that he's in, maybe that one with Jeff Bridges. I don't know.
It would have to be on a highlight reel. Just a few seconds of
exactly.
it. You know,
we did get a lot of great feedback from our listeners in response to that poll. Also on our Facebook page, we've heard some of your thoughts already. We'll share a few more of those thoughts a bit later. Next week, our plan is to review the new Lego movie. Yes, it will have been out at that point for 2 weeks, but it's gotten surprisingly, at least to me, Josh, ecstatic reviews. And we're going to share, along with that, our top five animated characters. If we were really smart, if we really knew what we were doing, and this isn't a knock on the Lego movie, we'd devote the entire show next week to True Detective on HBO.
Have you been watching it?
I've been watching it like a fiend.
Okay.
Can't get enough of it. Counting down the minutes, making the kids be in bed 5 minutes before eight so I can watch True Detective in peace. It doesn't work, but I try.
Can't you, like, DVR it or something?
No. That's how much I want to see it.
They've got to be in bed, and you've got to watch it right away.
No, it doesn't happen, like I said, because I have four kids, and they don't go to sleep until about 9:30.
You're setting yourself up for a nightmare there.
Yeah, no, it was a total failure, but that was my plan.
I'm okay with the Lego movie. I'm really excited about it. I feel like I'm the last one in the world who hasn't seen it yet. I mean, you've already seen it.
I have seen it. I did take the kids, and all night at dinner on Sunday, they were saying, "Honey, where are my pants?" So the movie had an effect,
okay.
Positive or negative. I'll just give you that.
I'm gonna hope that's a line from the movie.
Maybe. Or just something we say okay, at the Kempinar House.
That's what I'm wondering.
Well, previewing that top five list and our review of the Lego movie, we're asking you about animated robots. Try here to separate the characters from the movies
yes.
if you can, though I'm not sure you should, but I'll play along.
No,
let's
you
try
should.
It.
For this poll, you should. You have to. It's not going to be Wall-E versus the Iron Giant.
Okay, well.
Those are our choices,
but
by the way.
It is Wall-E versus
but
the Iron Giant.
But it's the characters, not the movies.
It's the characters. Is this a slam dunk? Is this easy for you?
No, it's not easy. I have an answer. Are we sharing them now?
No, let's wait.
Okay, let's wait.
We will wait in revealing our choices, but you can make your choice now at filmspotting.net. You can also leave a comment. Please do include your name and location if you choose to do that. You can vote in the poll at filmspotting.net. That's also where you can get information about the Film Spotting apps, where we do very frequently share a little bit of bonus audio. It's our bonus content. You can only get it if you have the Film Spotting app for iPhone, Android, or Windows 8 phone. And Josh, I wonder if to tease our bonus content this week, which I'm just springing this on you now, so I hope you're prepared. You'll read this.
This usually means it's an email taking me to task for something.
No,
no, it's not?
Actually,
okay.
It's not at all, and I'm dismayed at how little people took you to task in the feedback, which we'll get into in that bonus audio. But I wonder if you'll read Andrea Shaw's note here. She's writing in from Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay, here we go. Just wanted to drop a quick note to tell you how much I enjoyed your very lively debate of American Hustle and The Wolf of Wall Street. It was so refreshing to hear such an animated, intelligent debate about two great films. Whether you love or hate either film, it's invigorating to talk about two movies worth being passionate about. Ultimately, I have to agree with Josh in my support for American Hustle, but I have to commend Adam's argument for The Wolf of Wall Street. I enjoyed both films immensely, but some of the arguments made in the episode regarding character complexity were really eye-opening. I'm excited to revisit The Wolf of Wall Street for the third time and see it from a slightly different perspective.
Andrea goes on, I started listening to Film Spotting about 6 months ago, and the podcast has become the highlight of my week. For a couple of hours each Friday morning, I'm transported out of my cubicle and into a world of dorky film enthusiasts like myself. Thanks for being such a great distraction and keep up the good work. So thank you, Andrea, for that. And I know, Josh, that even after we recorded that episode a few weeks ago, we were both like, oh no, what have we unleashed on the world?
A little bit.
It got a little bit intense. And I know that there are listeners out there, this goes back to fights Sam and I had, Maddie and I had, and now fights that I have with you. There are some people, as they put it, just don't like to hear mommy and daddy argue with each other. And I get it. In fact, to be totally honest, if I was just a listener of the show, I would totally shut off that episode. I'm going to admit it. But fortunately, it seems most people do feel the way Andrea does. Whether that's right or wrong, I'll just say it was nice to hear from Andrea and other listeners like that who thought the debate was invigorating and enjoyed the passion. It's not going to get remotely that heated, I'm going to say right now in bonus content, but we're going to get into some more thoughts on those movies.
We're going to go back to it?
I think
it
so.
It will get that heated about the Lego movie, I'm sure of it.
It might. You never know. More of your feedback on The Wolf of Wall Street and American Hustle, again, will come in our bonus content. You can get more information at filmspotting.net and just click on apps.
We need to give Americans a product they can love. A figure they can rally behind.
Sir, I have dissected this bill. There are no loopholes. We can't put a machine on the streets.
Forget machines. You sell the polls. Americans don't want a machine. They want a product
for the conscience. They want something that knows what it feels like to be human.
We're gonna put a man inside a machine.
One final bit of business we wanted to get to. Michael Keaton, my guy, with Jennifer Ely in a scene there from the Jose Padilla-directed remake of RoboCop. And Josh, these little bits on the show, we call these Larson Recommends. This is where you see a new movie or two that I don't have time to see, and you say a few positive things
branded
about
it. Branded trademark.
Exactly. But we know, based on a brief remark made at the tail end of last week's show about Monuments Men, that an endorsement of that George Clooney movie that opened last weekend is unlikely. But you did just come from this RoboCop remake. Can we keep the name, or are we going back to the drawing board?
We can keep it.
Really?
Yes, we can.
You recommend it.
Well, see, this is the wonderful thing about the movies. So The Monuments Men, which is a film that I was anticipating for a long time, largely because of the cast, just utterly inert, doesn't really work at all. RoboCop, which I don't think anyone has any real need for, actually is a good deal of fun.
Really?
Yeah, it is. And let's just get a little bit of Monuments Men out of the way. You've heard the old adage, there are some actors who you'd pay to watch reading the phone book. I would probably include Bill Murray, for sure, who's in The Monuments Men. But some people would also say George Clooney, Matt Damon, Bob Balaban, who's a fascinating character actor, is in this. John Goodman as well. And the artist himself, Jean Dujardin. I mean, you don't get more charming than that guy.
No.
Is also in this film. And every scene just kind of dies there. Clooney directed, I don't know if he just didn't have the right spark. It makes you realize what someone like Steven Soderbergh brought to an Ocean's 11 film, which is similar in structure, ensemble cast. This is a group based on a true story of American art enthusiasts, really, who were sent in by the army to try to save precious art at the end of World War II before the Nazis could destroy it. So a little bit of a caper film here, and it doesn't have any of that zip or pizzazz. The actors are trying really hard. It's just not there for them. It just doesn't work. So, oh well, too bad. RoboCop, I mean, I don't know. There are people who really revere the 87 original.
Which you just rewatched.
I did rewatch it because I have faint, you know, middle school memories of it, which aren't really serviceable at this point for something like RoboCop. And I liked it more than I thought I would.
All of my thoughts on cinema are
formed
essentially
there.
Middle school.
I'm starting to understand that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's people now talk about it because of its satire. Paul Verhoeven. And definitely that's there. It's the movie. The original is mostly a movie that's concerned about making fun of our desire for safety and how we're going to let totalitarianism come in because of that desire. So
that doesn't sound relevant at all.
It's more relevant now, which is really fascinating, you know, than it was in 87. But man, Verhoeven really hits the satire hard. I don't know how much of that I could take, but I do like the original. This one tries to do some interesting things in that it doesn't completely set the satire aside. There's a great framing device with Samuel Jackson as the new Bill O'Reilly. He's got this futuristic TV show that's essentially the same thing as the O'Reilly Show or whatever that's called. So that's pretty funny. He's very much championing this idea of bringing robots in to be law enforcement, even though it's clearly not working. There's an opening section where I believe it's Iran. The United States is now occupied, and they're basically enforcing the territory with robots. Disastrous consequences. A little bit, you know, I love the drone satire and the drone technology stuff.
You find drone commentary.
They get into a little
everything.
Bit of drone commentary. And so I love
they,
that.
Josh?
They do. And, you know, and so it's timely in that sense. In the Verhoeven movie, it was interesting. You know, you got the sense that the director couldn't care less about Peter Weller playing the RoboCop character. He was more interested in the villains, actually. This movie tries to make it a little bit more about his experience. Joel Kinnaman plays the role here, and so we get more with his family as they try to reconnect. There's some body horror stuff, too, in the way they handle how they reconstruct this guy, so there's a little bit of a Cronenberg touch. There's a lot going on here. Most of it is good, interesting, enjoyable. I will say the action is just deadening. I mean, it's like a lot of these video game. Remember when video games used to dominate action movies and everything became a first-person shooter type sequence? That's pretty much what Padilla does here with the action sequences, so I can't really recommend that. But for all that other stuff, yeah, give it a recommendation.
Okay, so are you actually saying it's better than the original RoboCop?
No. I think the original is just, it's much more unique in what it was and what it was doing at that time, especially, and in, as you said, how prescient it seems now, even more so. So yeah, I mean, it's not an improvement on the original, but it's still a good film.
Well, that's unfortunate, because I was really hoping that, like with the Evil Dead remake,
I could have gone back and
higher than the original, and I could have basically suggested that you needed to be stopped, even though I haven't seen either film.
Ruining cinema,
yeah,
because of my opinion on RoboCop Evil Dead.
And yet you have a platform here every week on the show, so we can still call it Larson Recommends,
even to everyone's relief.
A little bit of a mild recommendation there for the new RoboCop.
All right, when we come back, the final picks for our list of Philip Seymour Hoffman's best scenes. Last break, we had Hoffman's Lester Bangs play some Stooges. We go to a lesser-known Hoffman performance now from 2009's Pirate Radio, with Hoffman as an American radio DJ, The Count, broadcasting illegally from a ship in the North Sea in the 1960s. Stay with us.
All right, this was the deal. I asked all of you to demand of me to do a very foolish thing. You sent in ideas in their millions, but one idea has defeated them all. So I'm proud to announce I will soon be the first person to say the F word on rock and roll radio in the United Kingdom of Great Britain. All right, my aim is not to offend, it is to entertain.
But also perhaps to educate a little.
Because if you shoot a bullet, someone dies. When you drop a bomb, many die.
If you hit a woman, love dies. But if you say the F word, nothing actually happens. So here it comes, especially for you, the F word. First, though, this very fine piece of music.
Did you ever see a man with no heart? Baby, that was me. Just a lonely, lonely man with no heart. Until you set me free. Now I can breathe, I can see.
Time for a few quick thank yous here as we get to our donations and some fun listener comments. Josh, a platinum level donation comes to us from Carol Westbrook in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania.
I've been listening to Film Spotting since the show started, and I wrote to you about 7 or 8 years ago after I moved from Chicago to practice medicine in rural Indiana. I complained that your reviews were mostly indie films, to which I had little access, and asked if you could review some of the mainstream movies. You very snobbily wrote back to tell me that you were not interested in reviewing those films. You would leave that to the popular press. Oh, Adam. Fast forward to 2014, no longer in rural Indiana, now in Pennsylvania. You are now reviewing mainstream films, like the Lego Movie, I think. And I have a greater chance of viewing the indies on Netflix, DVD, and some theaters. Okay, it's time I owned up and made a donation. I enjoyed all your reviews of the Oscar films and have seen all of them at your prompting. Now, please have a look at my picks for craft beers to go with each Best Picture nominee.
This is right up your alley, Josh.
I like this. You can find these beer pairings in my post in yourbeernetwork.com, where I host the Beer Clinic. I enjoy your insight and humor.
Thank you, Carol. I did do a thorough search of Gmail to try to find that email to see just how snobbily Sam, uh-huh, responded to Carol.
Could you find it?
Couldn't find it.
Really?
Couldn't find it. No. And
that's been scrubbed from the film's
files. The last thing I'm going to do is be argumentative with someone who gave us a platinum level donation. But it is funny because, you know, nothing has ever changed in our approach to reviewing movies on the show here over 9 years. Like, at no point have we consciously decided to review more mainstream movies or less mainstream movies. We've always just picked the stuff that interested us the most. I don't know if mainstream Hollywood has actually produced more movies that interest us, but
I don't know. It was.
We haven't changed.
I think an intern probably sent that email.
Yeah, maybe. And I
did you have interns back then?
I think actually we became aware of it, and that was our first intern firing.
Okay.
So
makes sense.
Carol, it was all taken care of. But we'll post the link to Carol's beer pairings at filmspotting.net. And just to give you a taste, no pun intended, she mentions with her Scarlett Johansson's voice won my heart as Samantha, the intelligent operating system who is all woman. This calls for a girly beer that is sweet and light like Samantha. Among the multiple options, I'm probably going to butcher this, are Festina Peche, Dogfish Head, a 4.5% Berliner Weiss flavored with tart peach, and Pineapple Kolsch from Cigar City Brewing, flavored with, you guessed it, pineapple.
I don't know. What else you got for me?
Well, Nebraska.
Okay.
Paired with that, this is maybe more your speed, Josh. Budweiser, Coors, or Miller Lite, drunk from the bottle, as they do in the film.
No.
Those are my people. Those are my people.
I need something a little hoppier. Does she have something a little hoppier on her list?
I'm sure she does.
I'm going to go check it out.
But it might have some fruit in it, and that may be a problem for you. We also got a Silver Club donation from a longtime listener and big-time supporter of the show, George Ondahl in Red Wing, Minnesota.
This is where I praise the films you have introduced me to lately, and they've been excellent. But instead, let me make a plea for a contemporary Scandinavian cinema, i.e. post-Bergman marathon.
There are Scandinavian films post-Bergman?
I believe there are. Here are a few examples I've enjoyed, George says. Insomnia, A Somewhat Gentle Man, Italian for Beginners, Let the Right One In, Reprise, The Bothersome Man, and of course the Dragon Tattoo Trilogy. While I'm dreaming, one show should feature the infectious music of Siri Nielsen. Thanks again for all you add to life.
Wow. Thank you, George, for that nice note and your donation, as always. I'm intrigued. Some of those titles, worth noting, Let the Right One In, reviewed here on the show.
Reprise, we did not review it.
No, but his follow-up to that film, Oslo, August 31,
that's right,
was in my top 10 of the year, though I don't think that got a full review either. The Dragon Tattoo movies, at least two of them did actually get reviewed here on the show. So we've talked about a few of them, but I'm guessing there are many, many Scandinavian films. And then, of course, you have to define exactly what Scandinavia is, which...
I'm not even going to attempt to do that.
No, see, I seem to recall in our past, you know, lumping some countries in and sounding like ugly Americans. So I just see trouble down that path, George. But if you lay that path out for us, maybe we can follow along. Thanks to everybody who donated this week, including all of our monthly donors. We don't read you every week, of course, because there are a good number of you out there right now. But $2, $5, or the whopping $10 a month, it really does keep us doing what we're doing. Now I can breathe, I can see, I can touch, I can feel, I can taste all the sugar sweetness in your kiss. You gave me all the things I've ever missed. I never found like this. I'm alive. Hey, Film Spotting listeners, this is Matt Singer from Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit, and on the new episode of SBU, Allison Wilmore and I decide we need to settle once and for all who is the better podcaster as we review Ron Howard's racing movie, Rush.
And inspired by Rush, we'll also recommend some more movies about rivalries that you can stream or rent at home right now. To listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us on iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
Hi, this is John C. Reilly, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
You're not even willing to play Beethoven without your notes. Unleash your passion, man. Unleash your passion. What are you afraid of? You have the three of us to cover your ass. Unleash your passion.
You're listening to Film Spotting and listening to Philip Seymour Hoffman there as violinist Robert Gelbart in a scene from a 2012 movie called A Late Quartet. It also stars Christopher Walken and Catherine Keener, a movie unseen by both of us, Josh.
I have not seen it.
Well, listener Sam Emblem in Unionville, Ontario, listed that, fair to say, more obscure performance as one of Hoffman's best. Not only have we not seen it, I'm guessing that there are a lot of Film Spotting listeners who haven't caught up with it. It is currently streaming on Netflix. And I wanted to mention Sam's note and play that scene because it does remind us that there are not only a few Philip Seymour Hoffman performances yet to be released, but some that have probably slipped through the cracks and warrant a look. It also just seemed so appropriate to this tribute, that particular bit of dialogue there from Hoffman in describing exactly what that character thinks the quartet's music shouldn't be. I think he perfectly summarizes what made him so special as an actor. You always got that passion. You never felt that his performances were rigid or clinical, that he was just going through the motions and hitting the right notes.
You can't imagine two takes being even slightly similar. He seems to be offering variations with his breathing, with his pauses every time.
And his physicality, which I know we're going to touch on a little bit. Certainly as we get through my picks here, we're at our top three Philip Seymour Hoffman performances.
I'm going to finally get away from Paul Thomas Anderson pictures. I had mentioned the scene in Magnolia for my number five, where he was trying to reach Frank T.J. Mackey on the phone. My number four was shutting Adam Sandler up in Punch Drunk Love. But for number three, I'm going to go to another film from 1999, the same year as Magnolia, and it's The Talented Mr. Ripley, the adaptation of the Patricia Highsmith novel by director Anthony Minghella. I like the scene where he confronts Ripley. This is the Matt Damon title character, the con man psychopath who steals the identity of an expatriate playboy in Italy who's played by Jude Law. Before we get to that, though, I just love Hoffman's entrance in this film. I want to mention, as Freddie Miles, he plays this Ivy League friend of Law who suspects Ripley of foul play pretty much from the beginning. He gets this great entrance where he pulls up in a Roman Piazza in a red convertible. There's jazz music blasting. He jumps out, scatters pigeons. I love it because a lot of times, and we've already talked about how he frequently plays these sad characters, and many times they're soft-spoken or almost feminine in some of their qualities. And here he's just this leering satyr, really, throughout the film. I love that little difference in his personality. And when he finally does confront Ripley a little later in the film, it's a little bit like a Columbo moment, how he's teasing him and playing with him. He circles around, he insinuates.
Where's Dickie? How are you?
I'm good. Yes, thank you. He's gone. He went to dinner. He's at Otello's. Do you know Otello's?
No. I don't think he's at dinner at 6:30 p.m. If you said he was still at lunch, maybe I'd believe you. You know?
Incredible.
There's a great touch in the scene where he throws his coat onto this open grand piano that Ripley had been playing before he arrived there, and it just shows this disdain not only for the music, this wonderful music that's been playing, but really a disdain for Ripley. And then as he interrogates him, he goes over the piano and keeps hitting this high note, trying to irritate Ripley into this confession.
Are you living here?
No, I'm staying here for a few days. It's a new piano. Probably shouldn't. Probably shouldn't.
Did this place come furnished? Like, it doesn't look like Dickie. It's really horrible, isn't it? It's so bourgeois.
And it's just, you know, it's such a joy, even though it's a little showy, but also in character. That's what I noticed in all these scenes. Even when he was being showy, it was in service of the character. And it's just representative of how Hoffman played scenes like a fiddle.
Yeah. The Talented Mr. Ripley is a movie I've only seen once and don't remember all that well. It didn't make my list, but in reading some other tributes, in seeing some other tributes, just a great line from Philip Seymour Hoffman's in that movie that came up over and over again was where he catches Matt Damon spying on Jude Law and Gwyneth Paltrow when they're fooling around together. He catches them and he says, "Tommy, how's the peeping?" Only Philip Seymour Hoffman could pull that line off. And you're right, he does just toy with Matt Damon throughout. Uh-huh. Like, you never get a read on that character, an exact read on that character. And I think that's true for a lot of Hoffman's roles. Well, with my number 5 and 4 picks, Scotty J, a scene there from Boogie Nights, and Alan, a clip from Happiness, he gave us two characters who can't help themselves from revealing their vulnerability. With this character, and really my next two choices, vulnerability is what he recognizes and seizes on in other people to use to his advantage. I'm thinking here of Hoffman's Capote. He slyly and surgically reveals his own wounds, his own pain, to get others to open up. And the scene from Capote, among many that always stood out for me, is the one where Truman and Harper Lee have dinner with the lead detective on the case, played by Chris Cooper, and his wife. They're over at their house. Truman can work his charm on a lot of people, but coming into that scene, I'm thinking, how is he really going to get that Alvin Dewey character to buy into what he's selling? He's this kind of no-nonsense lawman. He's someone who clearly isn't going to just start babbling and revealing details of the case just because some big city writer comes to town. So how is he going to ingratiate himself? How is he going to earn this guy's trust? And we see it in this scene in two ways. He first wins over the wife with his celebrity stories. He starts talking about his experience making Beat the Devil with Humphrey Bogart and John Huston. And I just love this little gesture that happens where he's mentioned Humphrey. And she, of course, has to point out to her husband, that's Humphrey Bogart. She gets to feel a little special there. So when he says John, he actually waits for her and does a little hand motion to her, knowing that she's going to finish his sentence and say, "That's John Huston." So she gets to look sophisticated. That's how he works on her. She gets to look like the cultured one to her husband. But then he goes to work on Alvin by somehow transitioning from that story into a story of finding out on the set about his mother passing away.
And Humphrey had just about moved into the hotel bar.
Humphrey Bogart.
Where he and John.
John Huston.
Had, they drank every night. And I mean drank, you know, like famished water buffaloes. Well, I'd only just handed them the final scene when the bellhop told me I had a phone call. And it was my stepfather, Joe Capote, calling to say that my mother had died. I flew home to New York, terribly distraught. But when I got to the apartment, I could see that Joe was in even worse shape than I was. He grabbed my hand and he said to me, "Talk. Hey, talk about anything. You know? I mean, any subject in the world. Don't worry whether it'll interest me or not. Just talk."
And by the end of it, we realize that he's gone all that way, and who knows how much of what he's saying is even true, just to prod Alvin into opening up to him. I think they see right through that, and we as viewers see right through that right away if Hoffman doesn't play that as subtly and as gracefully as he does. If you know him the way the Harper Lee character does, and I love when they cut to her reaction shots where you can tell that she knows what's going on. She's on to him immediately, but the rest of us, the characters in the scene and us as viewers, are so moved and charmed and maybe only realize we've been conned at all after we've already said too much or after we've already bought into everything that he's giving in that scene. And despite being so different than everyone else in every room he walks into, that Capote character just insinuates himself into scenes and into these people's psyches. I realized that I could have done an entire top five just of Philip Seymour Hoffman playing characters sitting at a table talking to someone. Could have been just conversation scenes. And I think that's what made him so special as an actor, that you can have those highs and lows, the drama of some big, powerful performances and moments, down to simply having a conversation where you're just held wrapped by every word. I really do think that despite not being a Cary Grant type or someone that may have fit into a lot of screwball comedies, he was probably one of the best screen talkers ever. He just had a real way with words.
Yeah, well, and that goes to the fact that we've had phone call scenes already in our list. That kind of plays into what you're talking about there. For my number two, I'm going to go to a smaller movie that Hoffman did, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. And this is probably one of his most venal characters in this final film from director Sidney Lumet. Hoffman and Ethan Hawke play a pair of desperate brothers who stage this robbery of their parents' jewelry store that goes wrong, of course. And Hoffman is the older, more corrupt, domineering sibling in this relationship. He's a shady real estate guy who's already embezzling at work, and he's got to get himself out of that. So that's where he comes up with this scheme. I do want to mention there are a lot of good scenes in this film that I could have chosen, and especially between him and Hawke, a lot of good table conversation scenes, as you mentioned, Adam. And I want to mention one specifically that we heard about from a listener, Kevin McLenathan, who sent us this in an email. The scene I'm thinking of is from Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, when Hoffman's character wrecks everything in his living room. The scene is even more impressive because it's completely wordless, opposite of what you were just talking about, yet Hoffman communicates so much just through his physicality. It's a fascinating inversion of the room trashing scene from Citizen Kane. Whereas Kane is almost unhinged in his fury, Andy, the Hoffman character, is utterly impassive. Where Kane is a dervish of destruction, Andy moves slowly, almost as if he's underwater. And yet the catalyst for both of their rampages is the same. A loved one has rejected them, and in that rejection, each man senses the final crumbling of the fantasy life he has built for himself. Definitely like that scene from Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. I am going to go with one, though, that's a monologue, and it's an especially sad one given the circumstances of Hoffman's death. Here in the film, Hoffman's character is also a heroin user, and this moment comes after he's gone to his dealer's apartment, and he's a bit zoned out after taking the drug, mostly talking to himself.
The thing about real estate accounting is that you can add down the page or across the page, and everything works out. Every day, everything adds up. You know, the total is always the sum of its parts. It's It's clean, it's clear, neat, absolute. But my life, it doesn't add up. Nothing connects to anything else. I'm not the sum of my parts.
I did hesitate to make this choice because it would be really unwise to read this as any sort of real life confession. I want to make it clear that I'm not equating Hoffman the actor with this character at all. Instead, what I'd like to talk about is the way the scene and his performance does serve this film, because it's a rare moment of vulnerability for this otherwise puffed up character and real evidence of his desperation. The moment Kevin shows reflects that too. And here you get a guy who's in control of his brother, supposedly in control of this scheme, yet we get these moments where we see how much he's really in supreme desperation. And I also appreciated this scene for the way it's an example of another tool Hoffman used, and that was stillness, just being able to employ stillness. He took his time. He didn't move much in a lot of his performances, and yet somehow he still exerted this sort of gravitational pull. And that's what he certainly does with this scene here.
Man, there are some dark, dark moments in Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. I remember reviewing it here on the show and being kind of mixed on it, maybe mild recommendation. I'm trying to recall exactly how I felt, but it's one I certainly would like to revisit at some point. I love that performance from Philip Seymour Hoffman. My number two earmuffs here for those listening, maybe with kids in earshot, it's the confrontation with John Moore, aka if you already know the answers to your questions, then why ask Big Fuck?
That's his given name, right?
Yes. The Master, of course, another Paul Thomas Anderson scene and another conversation. Another charmer like Capote, but a completely different physical presence than the effeminate Capote. Here, he's the virile, commanding Lancaster Dodd. I really think this performance is the sum of everything we've talked about with Hoffman as an actor and the characters he chose to play. He's exuding control and power, losing control, showing vulnerability, that dexterity with words, until his rage consumes him. And he can no longer wax so eloquently. He's just reduced to blurting out that revealing phrase because it shows how he really feels about this man who dares to question him, that he just thinks he's the lowest form of man, the basest type of man. And it's the opposite of how Lancaster Dodd projects himself to be. But in calling him that, really, of course, ironically shows that he's the lower man.
Time travel does not frighten me, sir, because it's not possible. What does frighten me is the possibility of some poor soul with leukemia coming to you.
Traveling in and out of time, as we understand it. But it's not unlike traveling down a river, you see. You travel down the river, round the bend, look back, and you cannot see around the bend, can you? But that does not mean it is not there, does it? But certain clubs would like us to think that a truth, I say truth, uncovered should stay hidden.
I belong to no club, and if you're unwilling to allow any discussion...
No, this isn't a discussion, it's a grilling. There's nothing I can do for you if your mind has been made up. You seem to know the answers to your questions, why do you ask?
I'm sorry you're unwilling to defend your beliefs in any kind of rational way.
Oh, if you already know the answers to your questions, then why ask, Pig Fuck?
We've talked about his physicality a little bit. I was surprised in rewatching not only the scenes that made my top five, but other scenes I considered, just how big, despite how still he could be and how subtle he could be, how big he could be as well, how dramatic and theatrical he could be in his movements and his gestures oftentimes, but never coming off as too big or melodramatic. In this scene, though, his only movement is looking over his shoulder when the guy starts talking to him and questioning him from behind. And then at one point, he does stand. He doesn't step. He doesn't wave his arms. He doesn't touch his face. He doesn't do anything. He just stands there. It's almost like he's paralyzed, as if he's thinking, if I just sit still or stand still, I won't lose control. I'll beat this adversary. And the adversary is played by a great actor who, unfortunately, we lost in 2012, Christopher Evan Welch. He's so good here. He doesn't budge either. He just steps forward after Dodd stands. So it's a great contrast because he stands forward on the attack. Dodd actually stands slightly back when he's under attack. And Paul Thomas Anderson's blocking and his camera placement is so great. He stays behind the couch when he's on Dodd, So Dodd is always just looking over his shoulder. And it's this wonderful contradiction I found, because Dodd seems to be saying with his positioning, I don't consider you worthy enough to even face you. If I barely regard you, maybe you'll go away.
Yeah, he's hoping he'll just fade out of the room, right?
But at the same time, when we as an audience and the John Moore character sees him behind in profile, turning to the camera, it makes him look really weak. It makes him look like he's hiding something, which, of course, he is. It should probably be my number one Philip Seymour Hoffman performance. I love it that much. And I think it's arguably his most complex character and his most complex performance. I did at least fit it in here at number two. And we've mentioned some of the alternate top five lists we could have constructed out of Philip Seymour Hoffman's great scenes. Another one would have been just scenes of Hoffman losing his mind. You had one, right?
Yes,
in that
yes.
phone call scene with Adam Sandler. But there was a sense, whether he let it out or not, that Hoffman's characters were always repressing something. And it's
it
not
could
necessarily,
get scary.
It
I mean,
could get really
we
scary.
Laugh, but that Punch Drunk Love scene is funny and very scary as well.
Yeah. And I mentioned last week or the week before, I was talking about Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara and how they are really good actresses at portraying and embodying a sense of longing, that they're repressing something. But it's a completely different type of repression with Philip Seymour Hoffman characters. It's really a sense of disgust, oftentimes, and disdain, sometimes with himself or with the characters he's encountering or both. And that complexity really does make for some fireworks sometimes.
Well, I did save my master pick for the number one slot, and this takes place after Dodd has been arrested for, I think it's illegally practicing medicine,
right.
charges, something like that. So he and Joaquin Phoenix's character, Freddie, who was also arrested for assaulting the police during the incident, they're both in jail. They have the separate cells, but they share this wall of bars.
Your fear of capture and imprisonment is an implant from millions of years ago. This battle has been with you from before you know. This is not you.
Shut the f*** up!
It's not you.
Shut the f*** up!
It's not you. You are asleep. Your spirit was free. Moving from body to the next body. Free. Free for a moment. Then it was captured by an invader force bent on turning you to the darkest way. You've been implanted with a push-pull mechanism that keeps you fearful of authority and destructive. We are in the middle of a battle that's a trillion years in the making, and it's bigger than the both
You're
of us.
You're making this up. You made this up. You don't know what you're talking about.
I don't know what I'm talking about.
No, you don't.
There's no doubt that Phoenix is a force in this scene, as he is in a lot of the scenes between them. He's the louder, bigger force. But focusing on Hoffman this time was really revealing to me. There's that stillness again. As Freddie rages when he gets thrown into the cell, Dodd watches without moving a muscle.
Yep.
Just watches. And then at one point, I think all he does is turn his head away from watching to look down at the floor like this isn't even worth watching anymore. But it's really, if you follow the scene from the beginning to the end, it's a masterclass in modulation is what he's doing. You have this quietness at the beginning, and then he grows loud at the middle to match Freddie in his screaming, and then brings it back down to being just as calm as he was at the beginning. And all of that is meant to communicate to Freddie that he's just as much of a man. He can swear, he can get violent, and he can rage and be just like Freddie is. But he has something more than that, too. He's in control.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what distinguishes the two of them.
Who likes you except for me?
Nobody.
Except for me.
No, you
likes you except for me. Except for me.
You shut up.
I'm the only one who likes you.
You too.
You.
Just me, Freddy.
Just you.
I'm the only one that likes you. The only one. You're f***ing drunk. And I'm done with you.
It also ends with him urinating really loudly as an exclamation point.
Yep.
It goes back to that animalistic side of him, too,
it
where
does.
He's marking his territory. Didn't you have a theory
I do.
To this about bodily emissions?
I hang
emissions?
On to that theory
yeah,
about bodily
okay.
fluids
I
being
remember you mentioning that.
Very pertinent to that film. And also, the phallic symbol itself, mm-hmm. not so much a symbol, it's actually there in his hands. That matters a lot in that movie. So it's not a surprise at all that he chooses to punctuate that scene that way. I'm glad you picked that one because I do love that scene, but I could really pick just about any Philip Seymour Hoffman scene from The Master, and it could have been in my top five. One last listener voicemail we wanted to get to here before I announce my number one Philip Seymour Hoffman scene. This comes to us from Jim Pellini. He's in Bethpage, New York.
One of my favorite roles is that of Dan Mahoney from 2003's Owning Mahoney. And in it, Hoffman plays a Toronto banker who is a gambling addict, and he kind of funds his gambling addiction through embezzlement of his clients' funds. And it's really a very muted and internal performance, even as the character, you know, withstands gambling earnings and losses in the millions. And, you know, most notably, we see how the character try to hide his addiction from those that are closest to him, even as he, you know, completely gives into it by the end of the film. You know, I think it was really a performance that was ahead of its time in terms of his growth as an actor, and I think really did inform some of his best work in Doubt and Capone. I think it's one of its best. Thanks for the show, guys. Keep it up. Bye-bye.
Owning Mahoney, unfortunately, a film I've only seen some scenes from late at night, and I do recall some of those scenes that really showcase exactly what Jim was talking about, but one I need to see, and I'm glad we did get a mention of it here in the show. My number one Philip Seymour Hoffman scene, if all of our listeners, Josh, knew that you were going to find a way to fit on Punch Drunk Love, they certainly knew that I was going to find a way to fit in Almost Famous, which is in my personal penalty box, but penalty boxes be damned. He, of course, plays Lester Bangs, and the scene I'm going with, this was so hard to choose, but I'm going with the diner scene early in the film, Honest and Unmerciful.
I mean, I'm telling you, you're coming along at a very dangerous time for rock and roll. I mean, the war is over. They won. 99% of what passes for rock and roll these days, silence is more compelling. Now that's why I think you should just turn around, go back, you know, and be a lawyer or something. I can tell from your face that you won't. I can give you $35. Give me 1,000 words on Black Sabbath.
An assignment?
Yeah. Yeah. Hey. You have to make your reputation on being honest and, you know, unmerciful.
Honest. Unmerciful.
The lesson to a young journalist, because it's simply my favorite scene that Philip Seymour Hoffman appears in any movie. It's just the one I have the strongest personal connection to. And I know a lot of people listening are going to say that the late night phone call
scene, I thought that's where you were going to go.
Yeah, yeah. Is better. And I probably could have cheated and combined them, actually, Josh. Because
I'm so glad you didn't.
They really are bookends. There's no doubt about it. He tells him in the diner not to make friends with rock stars and that you have to make your reputation, of course, on being honest and unmerciful. He tells him on the phone later that if he really wants to be their friend, he has to be honest and unmerciful as he sits down to write this piece. So they completely fit together. And while I do love the sincerity of that late night call, the intimacy of it, and yes, the vulnerability, to go back to that word that's been so prominent in this show, I just love more the scene where William Miller is still hanging on to the dream and his illusions about rock and roll haven't yet been shattered. And I love characters like Lester Bangs. And I do mean characters here, because growing up, getting into movies, getting into music, getting into art, I didn't have mentors like Lester Bangs personally. I'm guessing few of us had mentors quite like Lester Bangs. But watching people in movies like Lester Bangs and hearing their knowledge and their passion, that's what made me want to make them and write about them and understand them. I always have said I felt like Almost Famous was a movie that I wish would have come out when I was 8 or 10 or 12. It's one of those movies in my formative years that would have had a huge impact on me. But it's kind of even better that I saw it when I was 24 and I was just starting to write movie reviews. It actually was randomly, as I've noted, the first movie I ever wrote a review of. It just worked out that way. I started writing reviews at the paper there in grad school in October 2000 when Almost Famous came out. Who wouldn't kill to have that type of instruction at that age, to get that head start? And the expression that Hoffman gives and the laugh when he says, "There's nothing about you that's controversial," that gets me every time. And the expression on William's face when Lester tells him that he should be a lawyer or something, you see how quickly his enthusiastic smile fades because he thinks this is the last person in the world who's going to sound like his mother and give him that same advice, does it? But then Hoffman realizes that and comes back and gives him some information he can actually use. He imparts that wisdom about how to make your reputation. And when he does, when he knows that he's saying something that he wants William Miller to really take to heart, the bravado of Lester Bangs goes away. He's no longer just pontificating. He narrows his eyes. He gets quieter. He lowers his vocal register a bit. He really makes it clear that this is something you need to understand. And again, it's almost a performance like the one I mentioned with my number four pick from Happiness, where so many different dynamics going on in one scene. And that's something he was just always able to do without it ever feeling inconsistent. It always felt nuanced. It always felt like there was something else. If the scene just went on a little bit longer, you'd go to some other interesting place that you didn't anticipate.
Yeah, I knew that was going to be your number one, at least something from Almost Famous. I think my honorable mention from that movie probably would have been The Late Night Phone Call. And you mentioned why, because of the quietness that it comes down to. There's no bravado at that point. They're almost having a conversation, even though that's not really it, as equals at that point, at least compared to where they were in the earlier scene. So those are great moments in that film.
Those are our top five Philip Seymour Hoffman scenes. Josh, what about any other honorable mentions, other ones that were tough to leave off?
I did talk about the sermon he gives on gossip in Doubt. Strong consideration for that, probably my number six. And I saw on Facebook, on her Facebook page, a lot of suggestions and some emails too for his supporting performance in the Ben Stiller, Jennifer Aniston comedy
Along Came Polly,
which surprised me. I mean, I reviewed it favorably when it came out. I haven't seen it since, so I have no idea if it holds up, but people did want to mention that, so probably throw that out there.
Yeah, that's all you got?
Those are just, well, I
wow,
mean,
you're holding back here.
I mean, where do you stop once you're...
Well, we'll find out.
No.
Because not only is there the We Are Uncool scene from Almost Famous, but I also considered the first time Willie Miller meets him through the glass when he's at the radio studio, because he forever altered the way I hear and say Iggy Pop. I cannot ever say just Iggy Pop. I have to say it the way Lester Bangs
does. I'm glad it doesn't come up a lot on the show, then.
No, it doesn't. The master, the processing scene.
Yeah.
How about the first encounter between them? I do many, many things. From Punch Drunk Love, yes, What's Your Name, Sir? The phone call that you had. From Capote, This Is My Work. The scene where he finally has to turn on Perry and throw the facade away and be rough with him and say, I'm here because you're going to give me your story. I love that scene. I also love at the end of that film where he breaks down. I did everything I could. Really emotional. Heart 8, Gonna Light the Cigarette, a.k.a. Shaka-laka-doo-shaka-laka-doobie-doo.
Yeah,
is one scene in Heart 8.
Cameo, really.
Yeah, at the craps table with Philip Seymour Hoffman. And, you know, I really didn't like Charlie Wilson's War all that much, but the scene that probably got him the Oscar nomination with John Slattery, where he tells him off,
about
is really good. It's really fun.
It's almost one of those that, you know, it's just preying upon everyone's desire at some point in their life to give it to their boss,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. It's there. I'm Gonna Hurt Her from Mission Impossible 3. And I haven't even mentioned 25th Hour or Synecdoche, New York, which we started by talking about how hard it is to just pinpoint one scene, which I think also speaks to the complexity of that movie. So we really could stay here all night talking about the great moments that Philip Seymour Hoffman gave us. He's gone, but he certainly won't be forgotten. And there are going to be, fortunately, other opportunities to see his work. The movie God's Pocket, played at Sundance. He plays a petty criminal from Philadelphia who tries to cover up the death of his stepson. IFC picked that film up for U.S. distribution. Don't have a release date yet on that. He also is going to be in A Most Wanted Man, which played at Sundance as well. He is the head of a German spy unit. It's based on the John Le Carré novel, directed by Anton Corbijn, who did Control, the Joy Division movie, and the Clooney movie, The American. He was also working on a Showtime comedy pilot, Happy-ish. I don't know what the future of that pilot is, but there are the Hunger Games movies as well, Mockingjay Part 1 this November and Part 2, which figures to be his last screen role. I think they had a week left of shooting on that, but I'm guessing they're going to keep him in that film that comes out in 2015. So not only are there films certainly from his filmography to catch up with, but a few other films remaining out there as well. We want to know your favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman moments or any reflections you have on the great actor. You can email those feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in limited release, opening in Chicago this weekend, a handful of movies. The one I'm going to highlight here, Josh, is Tim's Vermeer. It's a documentary from Penn & Teller about the inventor Tim Jennison, who sets out to understand, and that's putting it mildly, the techniques of the Dutch master Vermeer. I've seen this movie. It's a 2013 film that we did get a screener of, and I recommend it highly. Wrote briefly about it on Letterboxd, and I'll link to that in our show notes, but definitely recommend catching up with Tim's Vermeer. Out in wide release, RoboCop does get a mild recommendation from Josh Larson. About Last Night and Endless Love, it does appear to be 80s remake weekend. Hollywood
it's a
chooses
national holiday.
Three 80s films seemingly at random to remount. It is the new RoboCop with the Swedish actor Joel Kinnaman. Michael Keaton and Gary Oldman also star along with Samuel L. Jackson. About Last Night, which, yes, I remember, shot here in Chicago, an adaptation of David Mamet's Sexual Perversity in Chicago with Rob Lowe and Demi Moore. That's out. It also stars Paula Patton and Kevin Hart. And Endless Love, this is the 1981 Franco Zeffirelli joint starring Brooke Shields. It's been remade by Country Strong's Shauna Festa.
Who started calling their films joints first, Spike Lee or Zeffirelli?
I'm going to go Zeffirelli.
Okay.
He's been around a little while longer. The other film opening this weekend, Winter's Tale, not a remake of an 80s movie, but it is based on a book published in the 80s, Mark Helprin's 1983 fantasy novel of the same name. This stars Colin Farrell, Russell Crowe, Jennifer Connelly, Will Smith, and others, somehow improbably Eva Marie Saint. I wonder, Josh, if we're actually going to get 80s remake weekend pretty much every year from here on out. I'm hoping for that St. Elmo's Fire reboot.
Oh, we can only hope.
Next week on the show, we are going to discuss the Lego movie and share our top five favorite animated characters. We also are planning to start our Satyajit Ray marathon with the first film in his Apu trilogy, 1955's Pater Panchali. We are notorious for not starting our marathons when we say we are and flipping around the schedule. That is the plan right now. We're planning on it.
You don't tell people that, because now it just gives us an excuse to push it back. We've already pushed it back 1 week.
And now you've figured out my design.
No.
There is a method to my madness, Josh.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.